Now we will start part two, Decatur Herald and Review, April 27th. First article from Decatur. Living room knife fight seriously wounds teenager. A Decatur man is in jail facing aggravated battery with a deadly weapon charges after police allege he fought with a 14-year-old boy and inflicted serious hand wounds with a bread knife. Sworn statements say Gregory Myers, 57, wounded the teenager Saturday night in the living room of a house in the 2100 block of East Main Street after the teenager accused him of trying to trip him up. The teenager said he had punched Myers after Myers first shoved him to the ground, and witnesses say Myers grabbed a large socket wrench and hit the 14-year-old with it as the two fought each other. Myers then allegedly went to the kitchen and grabbed the bread knife and tried to stab the teenager with that, finally wrestling him to the floor on his back. The statement says the teenager grabbed at the knife to try and disarm Myers. He, the teenager, advised he suffered several lacerations to both hand and as a result of trying to disarm Myers. Officer Timothy Wisniewski wrote in the sworn statements, I observed the teenager to have deep lacerations of the thumb, middle, fourth, and pinky fingers on his left hand. I observed the skin appeared fillet away from his finger. I observed a deep laceration to his right thumb. He was taken to St. Mary's Hospital for treatment where doctors said a tendon had been severed in his left fourth finger, and he was transferred to St. John's Hospital in Springfield for specialized treatment. The statement also claimed that a 15-year-old witness to the attack had tried this during the struggle to grab the knife away from Myers, and he had suffered an inch-long gash to the inside of his left thumb. Myers told police he had yielded the kitchen knife to use as a weapon after being punched in the face several times. In addition to the battery with a deadly weapon charge, he was charged with inflicting aggravated battery, causing great bodily harm. He remained in Macon County Jail on Tuesday in lieu of posting a $25,000 bond. If he makes bail, he is ordered to stay away from both teenagers and the scene of the attack. The next article from Galesburg, Illinois. Feds urge Galesburg to give residents bottled water. Federal regulators are recommending that the city of Galesburg provide bottled water or filters to residents affected by high levels of lead in their drinking water. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is also urging Galesburg to pay for additional lead testing for customers who request it and provide more public education about health risk. In addition, the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency has ordered the city to perform a corrosion control study to learn whether specific treatments might better prevent old pipes and plumbing from leaching lead into tap water. The actions came in response to an investigation published this month by the Associated Press, which found that Galesburg had one of the nation's most persistent problems of lead in drinking water. An AP analysis of EPA data involved 75,000 water systems found that nearly 1,500 systems serving 3.3 million Americans have exceeded the lead cap of 15 parts per billion at least once in the past 3 years. Galesburg has exceeded that level 22 times over the last 25 years, including in the most recent sampling period last fall. Knox County, which is home to Galesburg, has also struggled with some of the highest rates of childhood lead poisoning in Illinois. In an April 20th letter to Illinois officials, EPA Regional Water Division Director Tinka Hyde said the agency was concerned about the elevated blood lead levels and the city's history of lead in water. She urged the state to get a commitment from Galesburg, a city of 30,000 people located 150 miles southwest of Chicago, to provide bottled water, or filters to residents whose homes exceed the federal action level for lead. Otherwise, we will consider other options to protect our public health, Hyde wrote. The EPA has taken several actions to improve the monitoring of lead in drinking water after the crisis in Flint, Michigan, where some children were poisoned when the city shifted to a more corrosive water source. Galesburg City Manager Todd Thompson told the city council in a meeting Monday night that the steps recommended by the EPA would cost about $90,000 to implement. That includes $33,000 for extra lead testing, $25,000 for certified water filters, $10,500 for bottled water, and $10,000 for the corrosion control study. He said that might take a decade or longer to replace the lead service lines at 4,700 homes in the city, which would cost $10 million or more. City aldermen said the poisoning rate were unacceptable, but several insisted that there was no proof of drinking water playing any role in them. Instead, they argued it made more sense to spend money removing lead paint from the city's old homes, which health officials believe to be the biggest factor in childhood lead poisoning. Also Tuesday, an Illinois EPA employee was in the city taking water samples at six homes where lead exceeded the federal standard last fall. Spokesman Kim Biggs said that move would assure that the samples typically collected by homeowners could be professionally drawn. Our next article, coroner. Most Ohio victims shot many times, some bruised. A coroner's report released Tuesday showed new details. Meanwhile, the hunt for whoever is responsible continued to expand, with more than 200 law enforcement officials involved. A 9/11 caller on Friday said the bodies of two people found in one home looked to be beaten up. Attorney General Mike DeWine has called it, the slayings, a carefully planned and sophisticated operation carried out against eight members of the Roden family by one or more killers. The Hamilton County coroner said one victim had a single wound. One had two wounds, and the rest had three or four or more. The report didn't specify which victims had which number of wounds. Some victims showed signs of soft tissue bruising, her report stated. Sammarco's office declined to discuss its findings, citing the ongoing investigation. Funeral arrangements for the victims have not yet been announced. Authorities haven't suggested a motive or suspects. DeWine had said there were marijuana growing operations found at three of the four places where bodies were found in Pike County, a rural Appalachian foothill region, roughly 80 miles east of Cincinnati and Hamilton County. DeWine said Tuesday that investigators had received more than 300 tips and are still serving search warrants. He said 79 pieces of evidence have been sent to a state crime lab for testing and analysis, including for DNA and fingerprints. Ohio and Pike County authorities are leading the investigation with help from some two dozen other agencies, including other county sheriffs. The FBI and Drug Enforcement Administration are also offering assistance. A woman who called 9/11 on Friday morning to find two of the bodies said that she saw blood all over the house and that the two looked like they had been badly beaten. The victims are 40-year-old Christopher Roden Sr., his wife Dana Roden, their three children, 16-year-old Christopher Roden Jr., 19-year-old Hannah Roden, and 20-year-old Clarence Frankie Roden. Christopher Roden Sr.'s brother, 44-year-old Kenneth Roden, their cousin, 38-year-old Gary Roden, and a 20-year-old Hannah Gilley, whose six-month-old son with Frankie was unharmed. Two other children, a six-month-old and a three-year-old, were also unharmed. Leonard Manley, father of Dana Roden, told the Cincinnati Inquirer that he first learned about the marijuana operations from news reports. Manley, 64, said he's sure his daughter could not have been involved in anything illegal. "They are trying to drag my daughter through the mud, and I don't appreciate that," said Manley. Manley, whose three grandchildren, Dana's children, were also among the dead. Manley also found it suspicious that any assailants were able to get by his daughter's two dogs. "Whoever done it knows the family," Manley said. "There were two dogs there and that would eat you up." DeWine said Monday there was also possible evidence of cockfighting at one of the properties, but he didn't know if it was relevant to the investigation. Now, some sports stories. Russell helps Cubs build on a torrid start. Addison Russell's two-out, two-run triple in the sixth inning snapped a tie, and the Chicago Cubs held off the Milwaukee Brewers 4-3 on Thursday night to secure their best 20-game start since 1907. Anthony Rizzo added an RBI single in the seventh, and Adam Warren, 2-0, struck out three in two scoreless innings as the Cubs improved to 15-5, surpassing the 1969 club's 14-6 start. The 1907 World Series winning team began 16-4. Ryan Braun's pinch hit, two-run double off Pedro Strop in the eighth got the Brewers within a run, but Hector Rondon pitched a scoreless ninth for his fourth save. With a 16-mile-per-hour wind blowing and the wind chill 34 degrees at the first pitch, runs were at a premium. Third baseman Aaron Hill's fielding area to begin the sixth led to two unearned runs off Jimmy Nelson, 3-2 in the Brewers' fourth loss in five games. Russell's triple into the left center gap off Carlos Torres was one of the few balls with enough power to get deep into the outfield. Russell also singled. Cubs manager Joe Maddon lifted starter Kyle Hendricks, one run, two hits, 69 pitches, for pinch hitter Tommy La Stella, with runners at second and third and one out in the fifth. La Stella walked, but the Cubs managed only one run on Dexter Fowler's sacrifice fly to tie at one. Hill's sacrifice fly in the second provided Milwaukee's only run for Nelson, who struck out six through four innings before control problems ended his night. The Cubs started a stretch of 16 of 19 at Wrigley Field, and the weather made for a night of small ball for a team that once won nine games by five runs or more. Now we'll read an article regarding University of Illinois football. Phase 1 concludes. University of Illinois spring football practice ended much the way it began Tuesday, inside Memorial Stadium with winds swirling and temperatures plunging. Phase 1 of Lovey Ball has been installed. 15 practices have brought a new coaching staff in close touch with the players they inherited, and head coach Lovey Smith seemed pleased with the progress made since practice began on April 1st. "We know the personnel a lot better, and players know exactly how we run a practice," Smith said. "They know the tempo of things, how we do things, the Illini way as much as anything. That's what we wanted to get accomplished this spring." Smith said the Illini way is an overall level of expectation and stretches from academic to social to athletic conduct. "It's how we do everything, from being good students, our expectations of being a teammate, and teammates being able to count on you, to what we do as football players," Smith said. "Players have told us who they are. We have an idea of what we can expect from them this fall. What Smith expects is success. Our talent is good enough for us to win this year. That's how we see it." Next up is getting assistant coaches on the road recruiting while Smith schedules individual meetings that will share detailed observations and expectations for each player. That's pretty important, he said, now that I can talk about strengths and weaknesses and plans going forward. That's the next order of business. Once you finish a phase, you give immediate feedback. Some of the Illini assistant coaches were leaving town Tuesday night for the staff's first opportunity to have face-to-face visits off campus. Other coaches hit the road today. But Coach Smith didn't have to leave Memorial Stadium turf Tuesday to get his first two commitments from high school prospects. A pair of Chicago area wide receivers from the class of 2017 verbally committed at the same time, getting handshakes and hugs from Smith. Ricky Smalling, a four-star wideout from Oak Lawn, Brother Rice, and Kendall Smith, a three-star receiver from Bolingbrook, told Smith they'll be a part of his first recruiting class. Coaches were allowed to recruit off campus on April 15th, but Illinois is getting a late start due to the coaching transition that pushed back the start of spring practice. We're anxious to get out there, but recruiting has already begun, Smith said. We've had a lot of players visiting us on campus. You can see we have had a group in today. They've come down to see how we are doing things, and that's a good start. Like most of Illini players, junior defensive end Carroll Phillips said he was nervous when spring ball began on April 1st. He didn't know what to expect from Lovie Smith and from his new defensive coordinator, Hardy Nickerson. I feel a lot better about the defense now, Phillips said. We prepared for everything and we learned the scheme that Coach Lovie and Coach Hardy put in for the coming season. Our new coaches are more than what I thought they'd be, especially coming in with their NFL schemes. Coach Fair, defensive line coach Mike Fair, used to preach about how it is at the NFL level, how you have to get off the ball faster, and I can see that now. Fair, whose defensive line Smith has mentioned as a strength of his team, said there's still work to be done, but the progress made since April 1st is considerable. We're getting there, Fair said. We still have a ways to go, but you can see how it's coming together. It's nice to see communication, linebackers talking, and things like that. That's a fun thing to watch. A lot got made of the fact that a lot of us have coached in the NFL, but you know what? Football is football. The structure might be a little different, but it's still football. It's not that big a deal. Now we will turn to the obituaries in our paper, April 27th, Herald and Review. Fred F. Brosen, 75, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away April 24, 2016, in his home. He was born, was one of six children in Decatur. There will be no public services as Fred wished to be cremated. A private memorial service will be held at home at a later time. Thank you, everyone in the ICU and IMC, hospice nurses, etc., for your care and support during Dad's last couple of weeks. Memorials may be given at the donor's choice. Marjorie K. Ellis. Marjorie K. Ellis, 78, of Decatur, passed away Monday night, April 25, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. She was born in Wayne County, Tennessee. She was previously employed with Caterpillar, retiring with over 24 years of service. Services to celebrate Marjorie's life will be at 11:30 a.m. Thursday, April 28, 2016, at Pilgrim Lutheran Church, 22155 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur. Memorials in Marjorie's honor may be directed to Pilgrim Lutheran Church or to Susan K. Coleman at P.O. Box 65309, Dallas, Texas, 75265-0309. The family of Marjorie K. Ellis is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, 2091 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur. Please view the online obituary, send the condolences, and share memories at www.gracelandfairlawn.com. Bertha Lee Fox, 85, Decatur, died Thursday, April 21st, 2016. Services, 11 a.m. Saturday, House of Faith, Church of God in Christ, burial, Graceland Cemetery, arrangements by Walker Funeral Service and Chapel, Memorials, Miracle Temple Church of God in Christ. R. Buster Powell, 2nd, 77, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 6:56 p.m. Thursday, April 14, 2016. A memorial mass will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 28th at St. Thomas Catholic Church. Visitation will be held at 10 a.m. at the church. Britt Lickner and Earl Funeral Homes, Decatur, are assisting the family. Condolences may be left to the family in care of Britt Lickner and Earl Funeral Home at www.brittlingerandearl.com. Ruth Mary Gilman. Ruth S. Gilman, born Ruth Mary Sutherland in 1919 in Jackson, Michigan. Ruth was a longtime resident of Lawrenceville, New Jersey, before moving to Skillman, New Jersey. A memorial service will be held on May 28, 2016 at 10:30 a.m. at the Illini Congregational Congregation Church in Warrensburg, Illinois. Burial will be held at the Illini Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Presbyterian Church of Lawrenceville, New Jersey, or the charity of one's choice. Next article, a synthesizer of sound. Prince rewrote the rule book. Prince could play guitar like Carlos Santana or Jimi Hendrix, sing like James Brown, turn out pop melodies worthy of Motown, or lay down the deepest grooves this side of Sly and the Family Stone. But no one could mistake his sound for anyone but Prince. The dazzling, talented, and charismatic singer, songwriter, arranger, and instrumentalist who died Thursday at his home drew upon the history of modern popular music and created a gender and genre-defined blend of rock, funk, and soul, with hits including 1999 Purple Rain and Little Red Corvette. Prince's records sold more than 100 million copies and earned him Grammys and an Academy Award. The Minneapolis native stood just 5'2", yet made a powerful impact on at the dawn of the MTV era, proving that be the Little Richard of the 80s. From his wispy mustache and tall pompadour to his colorful and suggestive outfits, the counterpart to the openly erotic lyrics that made him one of the most sexually daring artist of the era. But his greatest legacy was as a musician, summoning original and compelling sounds at will, whether playing guitar in a flamboyant style that drew on Hendrix, switching his vocal from a nasally screamy to an erotic falsetto, or turning out album after album of stunningly innovative material. Among his other notable releases, Sign of the Times, Graffiti Bridge, and the Black Album, he rewrote the rule books, forging a synthesis of black funk and white rock that served as a blueprint for cutting-edge music in the 80s, read his dedication in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Prince made dance music that rocked and rock music that had bristling, funky backbone. From the beginning, Prince and his music were and grunge is sly, sexy, and provocative. The 57-year-old superstar passed away Thursday at his home in suburban Minneapolis. The local sheriff said deputies found Prince unresponsive in an elevator late Thursday morning after being summoned to his home, but that first responders could not revive him. I am confirming that Prince, the legendary, iconic performer, has died at his home this morning at Paisley Park, his publicist, Yvette Noel Scherr, told the Associated Press in a phone call. No details about what may have caused his death have been released. Prince postponed a concert in Atlanta on April 7th, saying he had fallen ill with the flu, and he apologized to fans during a makeup concert last week. An autopsy is scheduled for Friday. Mick Jagger was among numerous musicians, actors, and other public figures praising the artist, tweeting, "Prince's talent was limitless. He was one of the most unique and talented artists of the past 30 years. Madonna called him a true visionary," while Oprah Winfrey tweeted, "Prince, the doves really are crying now, listening to your music, remembering you." Even President Barack Obama, for whom Prince was a White House guest last year, released a statement saying he and his wife joined millions of fans from around the world in mourning Prince's sudden death. Few artists have influenced the world and trajectory of popular music more distinctly or touched quite so many people with their talent, Obama said. "A strong spirit transcends rules," Prince once said, "and nobody's spirit was stronger, bolder, or more creative." Buildings around the country glowed with the artist's signature purple Thursday night. Born Prince Rogers Nelson, Prince broke through in the late 1970s with hits "Why You Wanna Treat Me So Bad" and "I Wanna Be Your Lover," and soared over the following decade with such albums as 1999 and Purple Rain. The title song from 1999, his funky and flippant anthem song, An Oncoming Nuclear Holocaust, includes one of the most quoted refrains of popular culture: "Tonight I'm going to party like it's 1999. A letter from the editor. Help Growing Strong Agency Prevent, Treat, and Sexual Violence. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Since 1985, Growing Strong Sexual Assault Center in Decatur has provided free confidential counseling and legal services, as well as preventive education for Macon, Moultrie, Shelby, Piatt, and DeWitt counties. However, recently they've been forced to lay off educators and counselors, cut their hours, and limit services due to the state budget impasse. Nationwide, nearly 1 in 5 women and 1 in 71 men are victims of sexual assault. Black et al. 2011. Growing Strong's work against this sexual violence starts with an in-school prevention education, from talking about body safety with kindergartners to teaching high school students about consent. Through a 24/7 crisis hotline, staff or volunteers are called to area hospitals following an assault to help victims inform them of their rights and ensure them they are receiving everything they are entitled to under the law. Growing Strong has provided free counseling and legal advocacy to help victims navigate the court system and ensure legal sexual predators are punished, but without state funding, they may have to close their doors. Growing Strong recently began raising money online through GoFundMe in an attempt to continue helping the children, men and women of Central Illinois who have been raped and sexually assaulted. It shouldn't have to come to this, but it has. You can make a donation to Growing Strong at www.gofundme.com or learn more at www.growingstrongcenter.org. Don't let politics prevent victims of sexual violence from healing and allow sexual predators to walk free. This is a letter to the editor from Emily Steele of Decatur. This is Bob signing off from the Decatur Herald and Review, April 27th, 2016. Have a good day.